This is Morning Edition on KACU. I'm Heather Claiborne. Miguel Lavario is the Democratic candidate challenging first-term Congressman Jody Arrington for Texas's 19th congressional district seat. Lavario teaches history at Texas Tech University. He joins me now in the studio. Thanks for coming in.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I wanted to start by asking you to give me a list of the issues you think voters of the 19th district care most about.
Well, we've been campaigning for over a year now. We did that for one reason, was to get the issues that matter to the people here in District 19. And first and foremost, without a doubt, it's health care. People are concerned about their health care being taken away from them, being more restricted than it already is. So health care is the number one issue. And also the economy. We're looking at good paying jobs that people want in this area to capitalize on the intellectual capital we have here, but also the growth that we're also experiencing both in Abilene and Lubbock and throughout the region. So I would say health care and the economy are certainly two areas that we've really been hearing a lot about.
And when you say healthcare, do you mean the Affordable Care Act or other things?
I mean that people are really concerned that there is that the other side has not really proposed a really viable and really good alternative to what we have right now, which is the Affordable Care Act. I think what people are really understanding and leaning towards is that they want more guaranteed healthcare for everyone. And I think people are really leaning in that direction around this area, especially in our rural districts.
Now, I wanted to actually ask you about immigration. Congressman Arrington has aligned himself with President Trump on the issue. A UT Texas Tribune poll earlier this year showed that 42% of Texans believe the U.S. lets in too many legal immigrants. It also showed a huge gap between Republicans and Democrats on the border wall. 83% of Texas Democrats oppose it, and 73% of Republicans support it. I know you've written a book and chapters for other books on immigration. What do you think is the biggest misconception Texans have about immigration?
We don't have an open border. We have not had an open border since 1848, and if you want me to get technical, since at least 1917. So this idea that we have an open border is completely false, I would say. We have one of the most militarized borders in the world, in which it's only rivaled by what we see in Korea and in the West Bank. So to have this concept, and that's what's really problematic about this debate, is that we're having a lot of legislators and representatives not necessarily starting this discussion on the right foot or on facts. At the end of the President Obama's administration, we were at a negative zero when it came to migration. That means that more people were moving south than they were coming here. So this concept of a porous border, of an open border, of people flooding into our country is highly inaccurate, to put it very lightly. So as one who has studied this ebb and flow for as a profession, but also I'm a product of the border. I'm originally from El Paso, Texas. And so the border is home to me in a sense of where I come from and what shaped me. We also see it. I go back there quite often because my parents are still there. And we see it as an interconnected community, not a community that's divided by walls or fences or what's currently right there.
Now, when you see the debate over policy, what is it that you think would be in the best interest of the state of Texas, of the United States as a whole?
I think it's understanding that we do not have a magic wand or a magic one-size-fits-all solution, that we need to understand immigration, the smuggling of illicit goods, and national security as three separate issues, because that's what they are. We do depend on immigration. We depend on in our hospitals. We depend on it in our small towns around the district where they're building up small businesses, where they're contributing to the different farms and ranches. Immigrants contribute in every facet of our society. Also, we also understand that we need to have secure borders and secure our nation. But at the same time, we have to understand that there is other ways of doing it that a 15th century solution like a wall is not going to necessarily accomplish. We look at, the 9/11 incident. The wall would not have stopped that. A wall will not stop a lot of the issues that we have regarding our national security. So by approaching it as three separate issues, we're able to understand and able to get to some real solutions that are workable.
Do you think there's a way to find common ground to write policy that will address the concerns of voters on both sides of these issues?
I think there is, because I think that people every day are exposed to the fact that immigration is a part of our life and it's a part of our history. You know, we romanticize a lot about Ellis Island, but those people were not necessarily well received either. So a lot of us have those shared experiences or those shared stories, and it doesn't matter what ethnicity or what race you are, with the exception, of course, African-Americans have a different background when it comes to that. But when it looks at non-African-Americans, we have a lot of shared immigration stories. So that we can have common ground and say, look, not everybody came in the right way. We don't really have laws when it came to immigration restriction until about 100 years ago. So there's a way that we have to understand, I think, that looking at history, but also looking at what's worked, because a lot of the solutions that are being proposed right now, we've actually done those in the past, and we've found them to be ineffective and inefficient. And in fact, it's also hurt some of our industries and our farms and also our communities.
Would you have suggestions for, you know, keys to immigration policy that you think would be effective and beneficial?
I do. I think that one of the biggest concerns that people have is the lack of documentation, the idea that we want to know who's coming in and what their intentions are. That's perfectly fair. Everybody wants that. And even the immigrants want to be documented because they don't want to be living in the shadows. They don't want to be looking over their shoulders. I think if we could provide an efficient, cost-effective way of processing migrants into this country to where they're not waiting 10, 15, in some cases 20 years to get their legalization, or, you know, if we can rectify that and allow them to come in and it's not costing them thousands of dollars, then we can have what we want. People that are documented, accounted for, and are able to fully and successfully contribute as they already are to our society without fear of being deported or fear of that, you know, that they're not fully recognized and have the rights that they're afforded because they're contributing to our society.
Meanwhile, the Trump administration is proposing cutting caps on legal immigration itself.
Yeah, and then I think that's a slippery slope that the Republicans and the White House are actually venturing on. You know, at what point are you going to be limiting what rights and privileges we have? Permanent residents or legal residents pay taxes, as so do undocumented immigrants, by the way. So the idea that you want to keep them off of having legal standing because they took social services, well, I'm sorry, but the fact is they did contribute financially to those social services, as we all taxpayers do. I mean, you don't go to the gas pump and they ask you, are you a citizen or not, so they can discount the gas tax from you, do they? No. When you rent an apartment, you're still paying property tax. So this idea is very, very complicated and very disturbing when you are seeing a White House and in some cases his Republican colleagues wanting to say, let's start restricting what your citizenship or what your legal status is can afford you. And that's very problematic. And we're venturing into a very dangerous slope here.
Let's move on to agriculture. Mm-hmm. It's an industry that makes up a significant portion of the economy in this district. Let's talk about the Farm Bill, usually legislation which both sides of the aisle come together on. This year it was much more contentious. Mm-hmm. Congressman Arrington supported the safety net specifically for cotton farmers, and he also was in favor of the tightening of work requirements mm-hmm. for SNAP food stamp recipients. Did you pay close attention to this debate?
Oh, of course. Oh, and there's no doubt. It's front and center and for all of us, not just as candidates, but for as residents. And yes, I mean, I find it, you know, kind of concerning that you would have my opponent basically politicize what had long been a bipartisan bill. And the Farm Bill has always been that way since at least the 1930s when it was created to help our farmers who were suffering through the Great Depression. And by choosing SNAP to be the one sort of juggernaut, you know, we have to understand, too, that, you know, these are people that are in need. These are people, there are already work requirements that they need to satisfy. There are already a number of restrictions that they have to succumb to during what was passed during the Clinton administration. So the idea that my opponent is choosing to further politicize this one area at the sake of basically having the Farm Bill become ineffective again or not be passed is quite troubling, because we have safety nets. We need to bring cotton farmers back into the Farm Bill. And they were taken off in 2014 under a Republican Congress. They're trying to play catch up and trying to bring them back in, which is important. They need to be protected. There's no doubt from Democrats or Republicans that our farmers need to be protected. It's the fact that my opponent and his Republican colleagues are insisting on creating stricter requirements for people who are in need is what's causing a problem. And they're choosing to do that at the expense of our farmers and ranchers.
Well, farmers and ranchers are also facing the impact of the tariff war.
Yes, they are.
The trade war. Some of the extra supports that the president has suggested to offset mm-hmm. the impacts have been, you know, rejected, or some of the farmers have been, you know, hesitant to be in favor of them, saying they would just as soon not have to accept that support. What are you hearing from the people of this district?
We're hearing a lot of those same points. I mean, for one, we had farmers that were really upset that my opponent and Republicans were attacking SNAP. They thought, and a direct quote from them was, it's low-hanging fruit. it's not necessarily important for us to sacrifice the inclusion of cotton farmers back into the bill and for us to protect and have these safety nets. So there's that one angle. And the other, of course, is that they're worried about tariffs because they're saying, hey, these handouts, it's not something we want. We're wanting to work and earn our living. But we've already seen an example of what can happen, what's to come as the White House and China get engaged in this tariff war, that the only way to relieve the pressure off of our farmers is by providing these bailouts. And I know farmers are not necessarily happy about that because they do pride themselves of the hard work, and they should, of the hard work and the living that they make.
Now, another thing that the farmers are dealing with increasingly is drought. Is there something that the U.S. government should be doing, something Congress should do about climate change that would help with ongoing weather events like drought, hurricanes, wildfires?
Well, number one, they need to accept the fact that climate change is real. It's a scientific fact. Okay, number one. And I think that once we acknowledge that, and it's like going back to the immigration point, if we can start with facts and start with what's happening, then we can start working towards solutions. And I think of finding ways to, of course, our farmers are some of the biggest conservationists in the world because they depend on the earth, they depend on the soil to produce, as well as the resources that come out of it. Number one, water. And we have to acknowledge that. And with climate change and the depletion of our aquifers out here in West Texas, that's something that we need to address, and we need to begin by saying climate change is real, climate change is a fact, and we need to address it. Whether you think it's man-made or not, that's almost not the – I mean, it is the point, because you need – if it is – I mean, it is man-made. Where man-made factors contribute to it, so we need to adjust to that. We need to see how are ways that we can lessen our impact on the way climate is changing. And I think that's important. And so by using evidence-based policy and evidence-based strategies, we can certainly help everybody, because without water, we're all, you know, quite literally dead. You know, we're all out of here. We're all not going to be able to survive. So for much less growing products like cotton and other types of good food and fiber that we have out here.
So if you can get to a baseline of agreeing on the bottom line facts,
yes,
then what are the key policies that you would like to see Congress address?
Well, we'd like to see that what can Congress do to support research. I mean, like I said, we have an incredible intellectual capital out here in West Texas with universities like ACU, but also Texas Tech and Texas State College and other universities and colleges around the area, that we can promote research and we can find ways to better farm, to better ranch, or find ways that we can help our farmers adjust to this change. I mean, we did this in the 1930s. In the 1930s, as we saw with the Dust Bowl, it took change for farmers to not have another man-made catastrophe like we saw with the Dust Bowl in the 1930s. So we need to accept that. And I think that if we can, like I said, go on fact-based, go on evidence-based policy, and allow for us to hear from our farmers. They're the ones on the ground. They're the ones that know it. But also, how do we do this so we can minimize the effect that we're seeing from climate change? And that way, we can also minimize the impact that human beings have on those climate change.
So another important sector of the economy in this region is West Texas oil and gas. Is the U.S. headed in the right direction with oil and gas policy? Are there aspects that you think need to change?
I think what we need to do is maximize the diversity of the energy resources that we have out here in West Texas. And when we look at not just oil and gas, and that's something that we need to obviously, you know, support, because we're still dependent on a lot of those that energy source. But at the same time, we're also in a wonderful and unique opportunity to promote renewable energy like wind and solar that I think needs the attention and needs the support that we saw oil and gas have over 100 years ago when it came to tax breaks or when it came to infrastructural support or what have you. So I think when we look at the potential that we have out here in West Texas in renewable energy, it's where we need to direct our focus and a lot of our focus to, because it's important, because it's a job opportunity for many of our people. It's a way of sustaining, you know, a healthier environment for everybody here in West Texas and around the world. And we want to be a leader. We don't want to let China be the one doing it. We want to be, and we can do that here in West Texas, which is something where, you know, attention being brought to us is not something that we're used to, but we can certainly do that if we start supporting our renewable energy sources.
If we can shift over to education mm-hmm. and school safety, there's been a lot of discussion about how to keep kids safe at school. People often paint with pretty broad brushes in the gun control debate. What would you want Taylor County voters to know about your thoughts on school safety and specifically on gun control?
We need gun sense legislation. And what that means is we need at least universal background checks when it comes to people who are able to possess and own a gun. And we need to be able to make sure that those who have that firearm are certainly capable and trained and exercise gun sense. And what we mean by that is that they're using gun safety procedures. They're locking them up in boxes. They're not keeping them in reach of young children. You know, there's a number of different ways we can do that. And I think when it comes to our schools, you know, there's a number of things that I think I don't believe that more guns in schools is going to make us safer. Texas Tech is an open carry campus. I don't necessarily feel safer because students can now carry or those who are of age can carry. I don't believe that more guns is the issue. We have a lot of guns already in the country, and we're still dealing with a lot of gun violence. So I think that's something that's proven that's not necessarily the answer. But we need to be aware and have common sense when it comes to how we look at it. I believe in strengthening the Second Amendment by having universal background checks, by looking at those. We have the majority of gun owners are responsible gun owners. They've already set the example on how we can proceed so that most people can actually exercise that by law, so we can protect our young people. We can protect everybody. It's not just young people, but also people in domestic partnerships that could potentially be violent and so forth.
And would you restrict particular types of guns or amounts of ammunition in magazines?
I think so. I think what we don't need is we don't need military grade or war grade weapons in the hands of civilians. I think that we need to honor the traditions of sporting and hunting and so forth. And there are guns that are built that way, and people utilize them safely all the time. But we don't need military grade or war grade weapons in the hands of civilians. Their true and only purpose is to destroy as much and as many as possible. And that's a known fact, and that's an historical fact. So when we look at that, I think that's what we mean by gun sense. You know, we can, you know, people, you know, with a handgun, for example, can use that as defense and can be able to exercise that in times of defense. While when you're having an AR-15 or something of that nature, it's really meant to do harm. And you're not really going to do much when it comes to putting that out in the middle of the night because an intruder is coming to your house necessarily. So it's something that I think we need to take note of. We've done it before in the past, and where we limited that, and we did see a drop in our number of shootings caused by those types of weapons. We saw it in Australia, and we've seen it in other places. So I think we definitely need to exercise gun sensibility.
This seat has been held by a Republican since 1985. Mm-hmm. Since 2000, four of the contests for the seat have not even had a Democrat in the race. There's been a lot of talk about a national blue wave and a chance for the pendulum to swing back towards the Democrats. One indicator political observers watch is fundraising. Congressman Arrington has raised more than $1 million, and as far as I know, your totals are around $55,000. What's it going to take for you to win the seat?
I think we saw a good example out in New York with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who raised a fraction of the incumbent, which is where I'm at in comparison to my opponent. I tell people it's a lot more expensive to avoid your constituents because you'd have to buy commercials and a bunch of advertising. Well, if you're out there knocking on doors, if you're out there pounding the pavement, you just got to worry about paying for gas and maybe a Whataburger or so. So what we do is that we've been able to do a lot with a little. We've been able I have a full staff. They're all volunteer, with the exception of my campaign manager, who gets a very modest stipend. But we run a very, very volunteer-focused, community-focused campaign, grassroots. I do every part of it. I walk the block. I walk blocks. I deliver signs. I meet with constituents in coffee shops or in town halls, whatever it may be. So what we're doing is we're making a lot out of a little. And yes, I know that fundraising is a big focus for a lot of people, and that's why a lot of people are perhaps thinking, where is this going to go? I can tell you, I can rest assure you, we have name recognition out here in Abilene and in Lubbock. Our signage is pretty visible throughout the two largest cities, but also in the rural areas. And people know me by name. I get recognized all the time when I'm out in, in public. So we've done our part. We've been able to do it with a shoestring budget, but we've been doing it by just going to the grassroots, and that's what we've been, that's what's made, paid dividends. So I think that money is important, but I think money is also a problem. We look at who's supporting the candidates, you know, the PACs and the super PACs and these unknowns that are also contributing tens of thousands of dollars or hundreds of thousands of dollars to significant candidates. We're powered by the people. Every single one of our contributions comes from individuals, comes from people that donate $5 a month to people who have given us a little bit more. So I'm proud of that. And I think that's the model that we've seen from Beth O'Rourke, and it's proven to be very successful. And I wish I had Beth's money, of course, but we've been able to do well. We could always use more, but at the same time, I'm proud to say that I'm beholden to the people of District 19, not to corporations or not to PACs.
What would be the key thing that you would want Taylor County voters to know about you as a candidate for the 19th district seat?
I want Taylor County to know that I got into this race because I wanted to serve my community. I have not held public office before. It's my first run at public office, but I think that's an asset for me because it's the reason I'm doing this is because I want to be held accountable by my neighbors, by my friends, by the community at large here. And I want people to know that I'm doing this because I feel in this capacity, we need more representation, not just from special interests, not just from the elites, not just from the traditional power circles, but from everybody. We need a more inclusive representation, and I think I fit that bill, and I think that with my focus on the community, we can definitely represent all people and not just a few.
Well, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Miguel Lavario is the Democratic candidate challenging Jody Arrington for the 19th District Congressional seat. I'm Heather Claiborne. This is KACU.